Thank you, guys. My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Robert.
Thanks for asking me to come up, Sam. My sobriety date is August the 1st, 2014. I have a home group. It's the Awakenings Group. We meet on Sunday mornings at 9:30, and it's a speaker meeting. And I'm actually in between sponsors at the moment. I might get into that a little later. And I do sponsor men in the program. So what I want to do is just, you know, like every other speaker, get up here and try to share my experience, strength, and hope. Try to be as honest as possible, and hopefully my higher power will work through me and, you know, give me the words and the stuff so that maybe I can help somebody in here. Sam just told me we've got a mix of old comers and newcomers and old-timers, so that's great. I'm a big fan of this program. I first came in the rooms. I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I grew up on the south side of Richmond. I've lived in Virginia all my life. I started out in the restaurant business right out of college. And for a young budding alcoholic, that's the business to be in, I think. Out of college, I worked in Richmond for a little while. Moved to Northern Virginia for several years. Then down to Virginia Beach with the restaurant business. Got out of that, then back to Richmond. So. Just did a little circle around the state. I'll just start from the beginning. My family, I think there's one alcoholic on my dad's side. I had an Uncle Bob, or he had an Uncle Bob that supposedly drank himself to death, and my grandfather had tried to help him. And so I just got those ominous, you know, like Bill talks about, his people gave him the warnings, but he just kind of brushed them off because, you know, that far removed, I didn't think it was going to affect me. And but from a very young age, I always kind of felt out of place. Just not quite right. You know, I was always in my head, and people didn't do the way I wanted them to do, didn't act the way I thought they should act. I was always worried about what was going on at other people's houses and stuff, even my friends and stuff like that, you know. And just always thought I was missing out on something. You know, life was very good, but I just thought it should be better. You know, it was never enough. Never enough. And that carried through most of my life until I found this program. Starting from an early age, I have a sister who's 17 months younger. My mom asked me to go get her for dinner. So I go down there. She's sitting in front of the television. Shannon, come on. Time to eat. She's not listening to me, so I go to grab her arm and end up pulling her shoulder out of the socket. And I was probably four, she was maybe two, or probably a little older. But anyway, always kind of a control freak from a young age. Needless to say, I got my rear end beat pretty bad, I'm sure, for that. But growing up, I always did well in school, had a lot of friends. I was junior class president in my high school. I was in a show choir, singing and dancing. I played electric bass, and I was in the rhythm section, and then they taught me into doing a solo, so then I got the singing bug. But we got to miss a lot of school, which was a really nice part of that. We traveled a lot and competed. Not like it is today, man. It's like it's a real commitment to get into these things today, from what I understand. But it just always felt awkward, like... You know, I was worried about what other people thought of me, but, you know, where the party was. Because, you know, back then we didn't have cell phones and texting and stuff like that. You had the landlines, and you really had to work at it to find all the parties and find out where everybody was doing. Because I remember Monday morning, people would come in talking about this party and the great time they had. And I'm like, gosh, why didn't they call me, you know, and just started getting resentments right away. But I went to college in Harrisonburg, and... did okay. Just, you know, I always did just enough to get by. Never really, you know, jack of all trades, master of none with music. I took piano, played a bunch of instruments, had a lot of different interests. I started working when I was 12 and bought my first car on my own. It was a 65 Mustang Fastback, candy apple red. My uncle was dealing in cars in North Carolina, and he sold it to me. It was a dragster, and he, of course, toned it down a little bit, but second night out, I wrecked it. second night out, taking my buddies around. You know, my dad said, let's wait till I get home and we can go out. And, you know, it's a lot of car and this and that. Oh, I'll be fine. Well, I had these neighbors who were motorheads, and a couple of my friends' dads came over and they got it running. So it went out, and we used to always go in the family cars around this curve and hear the tires squeal, and it was so fun and funny. And here I come in my hot rod and just right into the ditch. So my uncle came up, picked it up, towed it back to Carolina. They fixed it. But just that shame and humiliation and embarrassment, you know, having to ride the damn bus again. And but just stuff like that. And my dad, of course, teasing me for my whole life. You know, that stuff just ate away at me all the time. And you don't even realize it's happening. My parents were, my mother was from a Baptist family, so they didn't drink or do anything. She was very spiritual. My dad was Methodist, and, you know, dad worked, mom took care of the kids. And, like I said, except for that one alcoholic uncle somewhere in there, there's really no cause. It was just me working, you know. It's like I was just running the projector in my head, you know, and stuff would happen, and people, and I would just sit there and stew and stew and stew my whole life over stuff. People had wronged me, or, you know, I was so insecure on the inside. You know, I always thought I had to have a nice car and I had to have a girl on my arm, you know, because the cool guys had the girlfriends. So I just tormented, you know, poor girl after girl after girl. And that's just the way it was for most of my life. So I got through college. I carried a big resentment for over 20 years. I pledged a fraternity my freshman year. They said, you know, you should really wait till your sophomore or whatever. But the second semester, first year, my buddies and I go out. And we went through all the stuff, you know, doing the whole rush thing and the pledging thing. And I got blackballed the very last vote before we were supposed to go in the thing. And I just couldn't believe it, you know. Never mind all the times where they had to carry me up the stairs of the fraternity house, puking, you know. It took four guys one time. They told me about this one thing. I was face up, and they were carrying me. I started to get sick, and they had to flip me over like a sack of potatoes, and I was just throwing up the whole way up the stairs. And then I think I pissed myself in my big brother's rat room. So soaked the rug. But I couldn't imagine why they would blackball me out of this place, you know. I was a great guy, you know. So that's just an example of something that, you know, I never thought it was me. It was always somebody else. Why are these people like this? Why, you know, how dare they? And I carried that for a good 20 years. Never went back to my alma mater for any of the homecomings or anything. That I was working and stuff and always justified it, but it was that guilt and that shame. So like I said, I was in the restaurant business out of school, and that was just heaven. I mean, we would close down the restaurant as quick as we could, have some beers at the store, or we would, you know, some of us, and these were guys, this was a chain, so I had buddies at all the different, up in Northern Virginia, we had like 10 stores. So we'd find out either the after hours bar, or if we had a late night, just go back to the house and just start pounding. But we always had servers that were hanging around. You know, it was a target-rich environment for drinking, cavorting, you know, everything you want to possibly think about. Several failed relationships into that, and finally got busted one time with my first restaurant employer. It was another manager and I was training him, and we had a couple of servers, and they had some of their friends, and they were waiting for us to finish up. So they had the music going and having the drinks in the bar while I was doing the paperwork. Well, Domino's had a delivery place right next door, and those guys start banging on the door. They want to come in and join the party. We're like, no, we're closed. You get out of here. So they busted us out to their management, who called my boss and said, you know, just want you to know your guys are having a big party over there. So, and that stuff went on all the time. But they picked that thing to make an example out of me to these other people. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, once again, how in the world? I worked my butt off for these people. How could they possibly deny me a little, you know, some beers and stuff like that? So anyway, it's just the insanity, on and on and on. But, you know, it wasn't all bad. I mean, as far as when alcohol was working, it was really great. Went to some great concerts. I mean, I've run into guys that still talk about this one weekend. We went to Philadelphia and saw U2 at the Vet and just drinking, and they were getting high. I was the driver, just in my Firebird, just ripped us up there, went to the show, crashed at a buddy's house, and then back. And this guy, I run into him to this day. He's like talking about it's the greatest weekend of his life, you know. So it wasn't all horrible stuff. But, you know, we start working these steps and doing our inventory, the bad times start outweighing the good, and quickly, very quickly. But just crazy stuff. I mean, in the restaurant, when I was down in Virginia Beach, I was working with the group that we had, still had some Northern Virginia stores. So once a month, I had to drive up for manager meetings in Annapolis, in that area. So I'd go 17301 and that way. So coming back, you know, they were all going to party and have a good time, but I had to get back to Virginia Beach. So being resentful that I had to leave and, you know, everything else, I would just have my roadies in the car, my cooler and all my setup. So here I am one afternoon driving back and going down 17 from about Fredericksburg to, you know, where it comes out towards Virginia Beach. And speed trap city. So I'm, you know, minding my business, you know, got the cruise control on, but I guess I got bored, started speeding, I get pulled over, and just put everything away. I had it set up so I could just cover it really good. I'm dressed up like I am today, you know, coming back from the meeting, and I just, you know, give him some bullshit excuse, the speedometer's broken or whatever. So he gives me a speeding ticket and lets me go. So I'm like, great, I flushed out the cop, time to make some time and get home before happy hour's over or whatever. I get pulled over again, two counties over. And I'm just like, that's the craziness. Still just got another ticket, gave him the same story. I hadn't had a chance to really pound down much more than I was with the other guy. And I said, you know, sir, this other cop just put my speedometer's not working. I don't know what to tell you. You know, and I don't think he gave me a ticket. But anyway, that's just the craziness. You know, driving from Virginia Beach to Richmond when I was in the restaurant business down there just to see an old girlfriend or, you know, because, again, I couldn't be without a female to save my life. So got out of the restaurant business, went into the insurance and investing business. That's where I met my ex-wife, and we got married, and I thought she was very successful with this sales thing. And so I think that's when I started really looking for the easier, softer way. You know how we do. She's successful at this career that I'm really kind of a fish out of water in. Her family's got a lot of money. They've got houses in Nag's Head and Corolla and all that. So I'm like, this will be great. So we get married, and I realized right away that I made a big mistake. But I was raised, marriage is tough. You got to stick it out no matter what. So anyway, we're married. I mean, just to give you another example of how wonderful I am, a bachelor party, we went up the street, a bunch of buddies took me up the street from my house. I had a beach house. She was living with the roommate. She had started moving her furniture over. So they took me up to this place, had a live band, which I loved, and just doing shot after shot after shot. And we get back to my place, and the strippers are supposed to arrive anytime. And I can remember sitting in a chair, you know, kind of strapped down, and then that's it. That's all I remember. They'd gotten there late, and we just kept drinking, and that's all I remember. So I woke up in my living room, sitting on the couch, still in my clothes, soaking wet, pissed myself again. I'm out. My ex-wife's couch that she had moved over. My buddies are up in the bedrooms, you know, just like sleeping away. Probably had a great time. They said it was a great party. But that was just the story of my life. You know, I'd pregame. I drank over everything. Happy, sad, mad, glad. You know, I'd get really excited about going somewhere and just, or I was so cheap, you know, I'd want to drink at home a bunch before we get there so I didn't have to spend a lot of money. I mean, it's just, it didn't matter, you know, and I'm just, I hear people talk about, well, if I can just manage my triggers and all this stuff, everything will be okay. And, you know, life was my trigger, you know, everything. I didn't need a reason, but that's why it was so hard when I first got sober, because without the alcohol, I didn't know what to do. So the first marriage was still there. It lasted 7 years. We had got married in 95. I thought I needed something to calm my wife down because she was just on me all the time. Not necessarily about the drinking, but just, you know, kind of a nag. So I decided, you know, why don't we try and get pregnant? Maybe if we have a baby, that'll give her something to focus on instead of me. So we have a daughter, and while my ex was pregnant, my mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. So January 3rd, 2001, my daughter was born, and February 22nd, the week that Dale Earnhardt Sr. got killed at Daytona, my mother passed away 6 weeks later. And I was still full, if I wasn't a full-blown alcoholic by that time, I sure was after that. Because I just, that pain just killed me. And I didn't know what to do. Besides just, I was a wino at that point, red wine. And just keep glugging it down. And still gives me goosebumps. Because it was just that pain. And I can understand when people talk about pain and suffering. You know, because when we're drinking and we don't have this program, we don't have anything. We don't have any defense. You know, we don't know how to cope with our feelings and our thoughts and all the stuff that's going in our head. So a couple years later, I just went to my wife. I said, look, I think we have a problem. I think we need some help. And she thought everything was great because her parents were really screwed up. They lived in separate states. So she, you know, didn't have the typical upbringing that I did. And so she said, if you need help, you need to go get some help. So I went to marriage counseling by myself, and the guy said, well, this is how this works, and, you know, we didn't have the foundation to start the relationship. So he said, you need to go to a divorce counselor and see what they can do for you. So anyway, I was a nasty divorce with an alcoholic and a type A bank. She was a banker, just type A, just always knew how to push my buttons. So it was a nasty, nasty mess. But I was adamant I wanted half time with my daughter. So I gave her all the stuff, all the money, and I got to see my daughter a week on, week off. So I moved in with my dad because, you know, he was by himself. And come on in, guys. He was by himself, and he was always my big enabler. My parents were, because he had worked for Texaco for 33 years and saved a ton of money and was ready for retirement. And then they went on their first trip, and that's when my mother got sick. So I knew I always had that to fall back on. You know, it's kind of like my safety valve. So I tried not to go there, but I think I would have. If I didn't have that, things might have been a little different. I don't know. But so anyway, I move in with my dad, and I'm just back, you know, not having to worry about my wife. I start dialing up the old girlfriends and, you know, just doing my thing. The weeks I didn't have my daughter was, you know, wide open. And just to give you an example, you know, here I am. It's all about my daughter, right? That's what I'm telling myself and everybody else. Well, she's with me, and I go to put her in the tub. We're up there, start the water. turn it off. Don't put that much in there. But I'm downstairs getting another glass of wine. The phone rings, so you know, landline. So I pick it up, and I'm down in the kitchen talking. She's up there singing and just jabbering away. So I'm talking on the phone. I hang up, and I don't hear her singing anymore. So I run up the stairs. She had fallen asleep and slid down to where her chin was just like that with the water line. And that was in 2003. I told you my sobriety date is 2014. Okay? So, and I first came in the rooms in 2008. So this, we're talking another 5 years of just nonsense. I met my current wife and my soulmate and was able to get her to marry me, and she stuck with me ever since. But I just had no idea. You know, we can't see it in ourselves, the insanity and all the craziness. But yeah. So my kids now, my daughter's 18, getting ready to graduate from high school. My stepdaughter, they were 2 and 4 when I met my wife. And she is 20 and a sophomore at BCU. And my daughter got accepted to and committed to the University of Pittsburgh in the business school. So she gets her business, you know, toughness from her mother. But I think she gets a lot of her personality from me. But thankfully, they both turned out pretty good in spite of everything. Because when we got together, in the house we bought together, I had this room. It was supposed to be a guest room downstairs. But I also did a stint after I got out of the insurance business. I went to work for MCI, WorldCom. It was MCI, and everything was great. And then WorldCom came into the picture, and you probably know what happened with that, when all that mess. But they started cutting people, and I was working at home, which, you know, for any alcoholic, that's just not a great idea, I don't think. I need to be around people. I need to have people holding me accountable. That's why this fellowship works so well for me. But anyway, so I had this home office. You know, I was also doing some digital photography and video on the side. And what that looked like was I would shoot golf tournaments and take the foursome photos and like the party pics. I'd do these big corporate Christmas parties before the economy tanked, and they used to spend a lot of money on that stuff. So the golf tournaments were great. I would take my digital, my laptop, my printer, go around, drink beer all day, take the pictures, go back in the clubhouse, print them out, cut them, put them together, and have them there. So I could do the whole tournament in probably like 3 hours. So they started in the morning. I'd be done around noon, 1 o'clock, get home, get my kids off the bus, already half in the bag. And but I was done for the day working. You know, I did my part. My wife has a very successful nursing career. She runs a recovery room at a retreat hospital in Richmond. So I wasn't, you know, being the Renaissance man I am, I wasn't concerned about being the primary breadwinner because I was taking care of the kids at home. And what that looked like was we'd be at the grocery store and have the cart full of stuff, and they'd be, you know, can we get this? No, we can't get that. As I'm loading my wine in, you know, and worrying about, are we going to make it? And then I'm sorry, this cart, you know, there's not enough money. So I started pulling their stuff out, you know, because I got to get the wine. And just, I mean, I just cringe now when I look back at this stuff. And I've since made amends to them, and they know. My daughter babysits at my home group. Everybody loves her, and my other daughter came because the other babysitters wanted off on Easter, so they both sat. But yeah, they know about AA in the meeting. So anyway, I married my wife in 2005, and still kind of looking for work. You know, I'd been laid off from, I went to ECPI. I thought I wanted to be a web designer. So I gave that a try, but I'm not a programmer, you know, and that was another waste of money and waste of time when I could have been out, you know, looking for a real job or just doing something else. You know, that's another thing. Even today, I'm in a career where it's just about a paycheck right now. You know, I thought there was going to be a lot of opportunity at this company I'm with now, but there's a lot of younger people there. And, you know, I just turned 53 a couple weeks ago, and it's tough competing with those 20-somethings. You know, I'm not the Liberace on the keyboard, the computer keyboard like I used to be. And, you know, my eyes, I got these glasses in sobriety. My wife and I met, we were both really big readers, and I would start, you know, like this, like this, like this. And she's like, what are you doing? Why don't you go get some glasses, dummy? You know, go to the eye doctor. She's really great. Nurses are awesome. Compassion like that for any BS, for all the stuff they go through every day. But yeah, I never thought that was a problem. You know, I was ready to get like one of those selfie sticks to hold the book out versus glasses. My eyes are great, you know? So anyway, we got married in 2005. 2008, my dad had a stroke. He had moved from Southside Richmond over to Hanover, which was, you know, I don't think he knew what to do with himself once my mother passed away. And he's not one of us, but when you say stinking thinking, you know, he used to hold grudges and just would talk about the same stuff and rehash and rehash. And but his addiction was television and ice cream. And he became very sedentary. And then we just lost him last year to dementia. Last year and a half was really bad, really tough. But thanks to this program, it was like night and day from when my mother passed to when my dad just passed. Because I didn't have a program then. You know, I was just destroyed. We buried her in Virginia Beach, where my in-laws were and her family. And I would just sit out, you know, go out to the cemetery by myself with wine or whatever I was drinking, smashing bottles, you know, just crying, angry. But with my dad, I was able to be there. You know, I have a sister in town, and she did all the financial stuff. And God bless her, she did a great job at keeping his books, because he was getting calls, and, you know, his memory started to go. He would get calls from everybody, you know, just preying on seniors, trying to get their money. So he sent out some weird checks, so we finally, you know, it was just a little thing, and then it just went very fast. He had a fall, had a pacemaker put in. Then after that surgery, it went from like 0 to 60 like that. So, but I was able to be there. I mean, we were both there the day he passed away, in his room at his hospice place or his facility. And right after that, I went to a meeting because I wanted to share that strength, how I was able to go through that without being destroyed. So 2008, he had the stroke, and my family and I were over there, and we were playing some games and like reading the cards, and my wife knew he was having trouble. So, but I would go, he had the surgery and everything, and he was recuperating at the hospital in Hanover, Mechanicsville. And then he had to do rehab at Sheltering Arms there. So my sister did most of the sitting and the heavy lifting and all that stuff. And it was all I could do to get over there. And, you know, I'd have my wine in the car, go in, check in on him. Oh, I need to go out, you know, I'm going to go out and smoke or whatever. And then I would just go to my car and just drink and then come back in and, you know, back and forth. I just couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it then. And so then finally my wife just started having enough, finding bottles. You know, I would say I was going to try and slow down or whatever, but, you know, I was spending more than I was making, going to bars with buddies and, you know, just running through money like I had a good salary or something. But so anyway, I said, all right, I'll show you. I can quit. So I went to, we have this place called FCCR. It's like an outpatient facility. And she said she wanted me to go there because our friend Carolyn, who we used to party with, had gotten sober. And she was probably about 3 years in 2008. So I went there. I met with a counselor, and you know, she's going through the stuff, and of course I'm lying. You know, we're never straight with our doctors or anybody else. You know, how much do you drink? Oh, a couple glasses of wine with dinner, you know, maybe something before I go to bed, you know, whatever, just total crap. So I'm telling her all that, and she's asking me questions, and I'm actually, you know, telling her I do drink kind of heavily. I'm not giving her the two a day bit so much, you know, probably like four or five, you know, which is still not true. But so anyway, after all this stuff, she pulls out this case, and it's a breathalyzer. And I'm like, what's that? She goes, well, it's just, I just want to give you a breathalyzer and just see, you know. And I had a couple glasses of wine before I even went in there because I was so nervous. I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, my life's just flashing between my eyes. What's my wife going to do? She's going to, police are going to come. So do the breathalyzer, and you know how we do. We just kind of, and then, you know, like just that fake breathe, you know, we do. If you've ever had to do that. So anyway, she looks at it and she's like, Mr. Smith, you just blew a whatever. You know, I really legally can't let you leave. I'm like, what are you talking about? So I was just beside myself. I mean, I didn't know what the hell to do. She called my wife. She told her, you know, I told your husband. And she had talked to Diane when I made the appointment. And, you know, he needs to make sure he doesn't drink and come in here for the questions and all this other stuff. I was like, oh, my God. And she's like, well, you're going to have to come pick him up and all this stuff. I'm like, please, we live right around the corner. Just, I swear to God, if you just let me go, I'll go to Tucker's and go to treatment or do whatever you tell me. Just, this can't be happening. So I had to sit there for like 2.5 hours. And she finally tested me again, and I was able to go. But I just, so that Saturday, I went to Tucker's, which is a treatment facility in Richmond. A lot of alumni out there. And I was in there from Saturday to Wednesday. And that's when I first got my first taste of AA. They bring my home group, my first home group would bring meetings in Saturday nights. And actually the first two guys to come in were Kent and Josh. Josh would be my first sponsor, and then I've worked with Kent later on, same as who I'm talking about. But so anyway, got out Wednesday, went to my first meeting, and even there, you know, they say, is there anybody here at their first meeting? So I raised my hand, and then, you know, so then they focus on the first step like we do, you know. So we're talking about it, and I just heard all these people, and I recognized people in there. I'm like, oh, my God, that's the guy that does my family's taxes, you know. It's like, I didn't know. So anyway, I'm just like a fish out of water. I don't know what to think. There's a ton of people in there. And so they're, towards the end of the meeting, they start passing around a where and when, you know. And I didn't know what that was. So everybody's passing this book around. They're all writing in it. Pass it to the next guy. Well, then they skip over me. I'm like, what, I'm not good enough to write in this book, you know. Here I'm getting a resentment at my first AA meeting because they won't let me write in the damn book. That's for me, you know. So they hand out the chips. I go up there to get my white chip. And then he gives me the book and says, this is for you. And I just go back to my seat and I just start bawling. Just start crying my eyes out. And so powerful. And I was just, I think that's the first time I realized that I was really pretty broken. But again, that was 2008. My sobriety day is 2014. You know, so I spent the next 6 years in and out. I started that first stint. I went to the aftercare at this FCCR place where that witch made me breathe in that machine. And, but, you know, I went through that and I knew what to say. I was a great student, you know. It was all about your brain and all this stuff. And, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, I was getting all this self-knowledge and all this excited that yeah, I think I can beat this thing. You know, I can beat it. So I wasn't working at the time. So I got a job just doing some courier work. But I thought, all right, here we go. I'm working again. I really can't make these aftercare things. So I'm going to have to cut it short and explain to my wife, you know, look, this we need the money. And, you know, and she was just like, okay. Because when I first went into Tucker's, I called everybody on both sides of the family. I have a problem with alcohol. I'm going to beat this thing. This is going to be great. And, and then when I quit going to the FCCR, I think I may have overreacted, you know, calling, making those calls. I think I really overreacted, you know. I'm really not as bad as those people. Those people in there, you know. So I think if I just stay busy and stay out of trouble, you know, anything to justify how we want things to go. So 6 years. I came back. I was 2008. I came back fall of 2010. I went out for like 2 years to do more research. And I forgot what happened then. My father-in-law had passed away. Just, you know, I didn't make a complete ass out of myself every time I drank, but I never knew what was going to happen, you know. But chances were pretty good. If I was around a lot of people and stuff was going on, then I was going to just embarrass the hell out of everybody. So I came back. She had, you know, said again, her dad had died from alcoholism. Well, they never really, he wasn't in the program or anything, but he was a heavy drinker and died of an aneurysm. You know, he had a lot of health problems. I think the family knew he was, but just never really talked about, because he was a happy drunk. So, you know, that's the difference than me, who's Jekyll and Hyde. You never know what you're going to get. So I said, I didn't want to do Tucker's again. Please don't make me go through that. So we went to this other place where they put me on some antabuse, and my wife was going to kind of monitor my stuff, and I was going to go back to AA. Because I said, I know that works. You know, I didn't know because I didn't have any experience with it, you know. But I said, I'm going to go back. And, you know, it's so hard if you're new, when you've been out for a little bit, and then you come back in and picking up that white chip again, you think, gosh, what are these alcoholics going to think of me? You know, this big loser coming in here, you know, it's just all in our heads. But I went in there, the same guys were there after 2 years, you know. And the guy who had been, actually the night I went back, the guy who had been in my FCCR class was picking up a 2-year medallion. You know, I was like, damn. That's crazy, because he was nutty as a fruitcake, you know. So like, well, maybe if he could do it, you know, this might work for me. But that was 2010. I got a sponsor, and actually, I, you know, made that first group my home group. It was called Into Action. They met Tuesday, Thursday nights, a mixed meeting on Tuesdays, a speaker on Thursdays, and then we were into action the rest of the nights. We went to jails, prisons, took meetings into Tucker's, and they just, I mean, they threw you in there, which, you know, for early sobriety, that was great. So I did that for a while, had a sponsor, whipped through the steps, and then just did service, like I said. So I never really got the higher power thing, but they didn't really spend a lot of time on that. You know, it was all about, it'll just come, it'll happen, just keep, let's go to the prison, you know, let's just keep doing it. And it just didn't work. So I went 14 months then, and I had an uncle that passed away. Death really shook me up. That was a great justification for me to go out and get hammered again. So anyway, in and out, in and out. Finally, September 31st, 2014, I can't remember if I was supposed to be going to AA or what at that time, but I was still hiding stuff around the house. You know, that home office had become this abomination junk room, and I had bottles everywhere in there. I can remember my poor kids going in to do their homework on the computer. They had to peel me away from my Facebook and drinking, you know. I'd come up to eat dinner, go back, fart around, chatting with friends and all this stuff. And then, you know, they'd come in and say goodnight. Yeah, goodnight, goodnight. You know, father of the year, father of the year. But I remember one time they came in and one of the girls knocked over a red wine bottle underneath the desk around the corner, because she, and of course I was so angry, but how crazy is that? You know, your children can't even, you can't be there for them, and they can't even go in there, and, you know, it's just insane. So, it was a Thursday night, we're sitting there watching television, and I said something, she looks over at me, she's like, "Are you drunk again?" And, you know, of course, I'm like, "No." But, you know, I'd been out to the shed at this time. I had stuff in the shed and everything. And I was just like, "Well, I just had a couple, you know," and she just went off. She said, "That's it. I just can't." You know, we had this big argument, so I stormed off to the bed. I'll show her. I'll have one more before I go to bed. You know, just passed out in the bed. And she comes up later, I guess. But I woke up in the middle of the night, and her phone was beeping. Somebody had been texting. So I look at it, and she's texting with her sister, my sister-in-law. And it's all this back and forth. "He's drunk again. Oh, my God, what are you going to do? Do you want to come over here?" "No, we got the girls, you know, and this and that," and all this stuff. And finally, my sister-in-law was like, "Well, what are you going to do?" And just said, "I don't know." But I could hear her, you know, and just see her just that dejected. She was done. She didn't know what to do. And for the first time in my life, I realized what I was doing to other people. You know, I always thought, why is everybody on my ass? You know, I'm sitting here in this little junky room, playing on my computer, drinking glass after glass or whatever. Who am I bothering? You know, but I've got a wife, I've got kids. I've got responsibilities. I'm just not there for any of it. So I woke her up before I went to work, and I said, "Look, you know, apologize for the umpteenth time, but I said, I'm going to go to AA tonight, and I'm going to make this thing work." She's like, "Well, you've said that before." I said, I know, but I'm going to do it." So that afternoon, she had to go for a doctor's appointment. I get this call about 4:30. She's at home hysterical. She went to get her mammogram, and they found something. And it was pouring down rain. I was doing deliveries on the other side of town. I couldn't just punt and come home. So I talked to her, and, you know, she explained it. You know, they didn't know. She had to come back Monday for a bigger test and to do the biopsy thing. So, I said, "Well, call your mother." You know, my mother-in-law lived right around the corner from us. She goes, "No, I don't want anybody to know." So anyway, I called my mother-in-law. I said, "I need you to get over there because she's wigging out. She's a nurse too, or was." So anyway, I get home, and that was the right call. They, you know, everything had calmed down. And so I just said, you know, we're going to just go Monday and see what they say. So, but it was time. I said, "I'm going to go to my meeting." So that's when I went to a meeting that night and picked up my last white chip, you know. But I didn't do it right from the get-go. Spent a year and a half looking for just the right sponsor. Couldn't decide on a home group, you know. I like this group, but they're kind of, you do some weird stuff. A couple guys in there I really don't care for, you know. It's just excuse after excuse after excuse to not give this thing a fair shake. Until finally, a year and a half later, I was going to a speaker meeting at Chippenham, and I was just out of my mind. The session to drink had pretty much gone, but I was just out of my mind. I didn't know how to live life, you know? So I prayed to God. I said, you know, just kind of yelled out, "Please help me." And I went in, heard this speaker. He was looking right at me, and something happened. I said, "All right, this is the guy." So then I waited another 2 weeks before I called him, but finally hooked up, you know. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I get there eventually. And that made all the difference. We worked the steps. I went up to him. I said, "Look, I'm not getting the spirituality thing, you know, and I'm a real procrastinator." He said, "Well, the first thing I can help you with. The second thing, not anymore." So he pushed me, and we really went in deep to the steps, and he introduced me to some spiritual reading And slowly but surely, I started having those aha moments until I can't. And mine was of the educational variety. You know, I never had the burning bush. There was some weird stuff that would happen. Like the morning, August the 1st, that morning I had to take my oldest. She was playing field hockey for the high school. So they had practice at like 7 a.m. So I go to drop her off, turn on my radio, and out blares Bill's story. You know, I had an old iPod connected to the thing, but I had been listening to like AC/DC or something else. So I don't know how it got on my big book on my thing, but you know, stuff like that would just start happening. So anyway, we worked the steps, got active again in service. Before, I told you I'd gone to the jails and the prisons and stuff like that. This time, my sponsor, actually, he started this volunteer program, Hand of AA, which we are on call at certain hospitals, Chippenham, Johnson Willis. And now, in my old home group, we had a cell phone, like a burner phone, and you just pass that around. But this is like a cloud PBX. At these hospitals, when a nurse picks up a phone and says, Hand of AA, or just Alcoholics Anonymous, it rings to this number. It's really cool. So whoever's on call, it's usually a male and a female, and they get the call, you take the information, and then we just get over there as soon as we can to see them, you know, and it helped a lot of people. Well, you don't know, but, you know, we're doing service work, and it's keeping us sober, and because that's all we can do is just plant the seeds. You know, those guys that saw me 2008, you know, one would become my sponsor, then the next one, and we just never know. But that's, you know, this program is just so amazing. So working the steps, spent a lot of time on 6 and 7, and that really changed my life. He said, I want you to go 30 days, pick a prayer, any prayer, and every morning I want you to just get on your knees and say it, and every night before you go to bed, get on your knees and say it. Took me like 2.5 months, 3 months, but I finally did it, and something just started happening. You know, it wasn't just words anymore. Life starts to get better, and instead of taking my will back, saying, oh, I got this, you know, I do the same stuff every day now. The same stuff. I get up in the morning. If my alarm doesn't wake me up, my dog does. He comes over right around 5. Trying to get him to sleep in a little bit on the weekends, but he's a tough case. But anyway, so we go downstairs, feed him, make my coffee, let him out, and then I'm sitting in my basement, and I start, you know, checking in with God and ask him to guide my thoughts every day and tell him to try to remove all the bad habits that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and to you guys, you know. And I've gotten into meditation. I use an app called Headspace, which I think is awesome. It's got these beginner's things that just run you through it. Because all this stuff, I never had a clue what AA was about or meditating. And, you know, I've prayed before, but it's always like, God, please, if you get me through this, I promise. You know, it was, let's make a deal. You know, if you get me through this one, I'll do this. Oh, well, you boned me on that, so forget it. Deal's off. You know, those are my prayers. But, you know, I find I'm just doing the same things over and over. And I pray, have my quiet time, and read some spiritual reading. My sponsor and I actually were sharing this. We get a daily meditation email from this guy, Richard Rohr, who we both read, and is kind of our spiritual mentor. And so we would email back and forth about it. But, you know, and then I go and do my day, you know. But I also realize that sometimes I have to restart my day. You know, things start getting hinky at work. I struggle a lot at work. You know, I mean, let's be honest. You're dealing with a lot of people, depending on what you do. But now I'm working in this cube environment. It was a call center that we took over. but I'm a freight forwarder working with all these 20, young 20s to early 30s, and they're just yammering on all day long, you know, video games and just arguing about minutia, the Marvel movies and just this stuff, and it's just like, ah! But you know what? That's where I am today. You know, that's my path. And I'm glad I have a job. Jobs are tough to get today, you know? So it's all about your attitude. My sponsor, one of the first things he did was hand me this slip that he had printed out. Somebody gave it to him, and it comes from the chapter in the big book, Acceptance is the Answer. And that's my favorite chapter in the whole book, because it says, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Whenever I have a problem, I'm just paraphrasing, but whenever I have a problem with a person, place, or thing, it's all in my head, because everything is the way it's supposed to be, you know, the way God wants it to be. So, you know what I have to change? It's my attitude. Change my attitude. And believe me, this didn't happen overnight. I mean, I told you how long it took me to just call the sponsor after I decided I wanted him to be my sponsor. You know, I'm a slow learner. But, you know, if we just keep practicing this thing, it works. It works. And we, you know, but by practicing every day, we just read in a meeting I was in, Dr. Bob's Nightmare. And at the end, he gives four reasons for why he does what he does. Because he enjoys it, because it's important. And one of them was something along the lines of it keeps, you know, creates distance between him and that first drink. You know, the more, and it's, we're not immune to it by any stretch, you know, but it's just, I think if I keep doing that stuff, my awareness increases and I'm able to see stuff and I'm able to detach myself from thoughts and things, but that's how we can be of service. You know, I don't let my feelings and my thoughts and everything overwhelm me, or, you know, because that's not who I am. My thoughts and feelings, I believe, are narcissistic reactions to life. And if I can accept, you know, with that acceptance piece and have the willingness to practice this thing just one day at a time, because, you know, if I start thinking too far out, then that's when I get screwed. I get squirrely, you know. But anyway, I just want to thank you guys for having me again. I hope I was able to say something somebody can take away from this thing. And if you're down in Richmond, come see us at the Awakenings Group. God bless you.